Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and avocado too, eh?
Welcome to Food for Thought. Join us for a thought-provoking glimpse into the world of the food that we savor. Meet the women and men who are growing it, foraging for it, raising it, cooking it, and who share it with the rest of us. Today's guest is Bill Carvalho. Bill is the president and founder of Wild Planet Seafood, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the seafood products that Wild Planet carries. I'd like to talk about traceability, though. How does Wild Planet know where their seafood is coming from?
That's a great question, Jennifer. We are the operators of dock facilities, so we actually receive the seafood ourselves. There are brands of product out there that maybe are in some big city, or maybe they're in a small city. It doesn't matter the size, but they're one step removed from the waterfront. And so they're buying product already finished in cans from some supplier like us. But we actually produce the fish and game documentation, landing receipts for the fish that come into our products. And we know exactly which boats are harvesting that product. We know what methods of catch they're using. We know what region in which they're fishing. And so we're able to trace back our products to those vessels to make sure that they conform to our standards of sustainability.
And how have you developed those standards?
Well, actually, we don't have a whole team of biologists at Wild Planet, and that's not our forte. But there are those that have the resources to employ biologists to determine what fisheries, what biomasses really are healthy, and what fisheries are properly catching the fish. We use a number of them. The primary one is Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, and they produce those little cards. Maybe you've seen those.
I've seen those.
Yeah, and those are little guides, and you know what they say about giving a person a card. Give a person a fish, and you feed him for a day. Give him a Seafood Watch card, and you make him impossible to dine with. You don't want to go out to dinner with me.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing, and I've actually been out to dinner with friends who have said, you know, you have swordfish on the menu, and do you realize what a problem that is? And it's a tough thing to do, and you realize that the person waiting on you is, you know, not responsible for buying the swordfish in the restaurant, but you want that to get back to the owner of the restaurant.
You do, yes. And their site is really fairly complete for the products that are caught in the United States. And so we use the green, yellow, and red process of evaluating fish. Green means it's the best choice. Yellow means, well, it's an alternative, but there are issues with it. Red means you should avoid that. And all of Wild Planet's products are in the green category. We just don't even do business in the other ones.
Now, where are the fish processed, and how does that happen?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's no one answer to that, because our Dungeness crabs are produced here locally in the United States. Our tuna and our sardines are produced away from the States, and there's a really good reason for that. The salmon that we sell is caught and canned in Alaska. But when it came to sardines and tuna, things that are caught right here in California, there is no sardine cannery anywhere in the United States. There's no tuna cannery anywhere in the United States. Now, there are some very tiny boutique canneries that don't have the capacity to process the amount of fish that we need to sell across the country and make this brand a significant force for change in the United States. So we have a cannery in Vietnam, where I've personally been, and other people in our company have gone there, and they attend the production of our products there. We also do some canning in Ecuador. And those countries have outstanding canneries that they're really the canneries for the entire world, not just the United States, but Europe. So we send the fish there, have it canned, and bring it back in, which always raises the question.
It takes a lot of energy to get the fish all the way there and bring them back. And why do you do that?
Yes, Carbonville. Thank you for asking that question. It can be counterintuitive to think about miles alone when you when you consider carbon footprint. Because it isn't just the number of miles, but it's the kind of miles. Now, I attended a seminar actually about this, and I was shocked to find out that, just an example, New Zealand lamb has a lower carbon footprint in the London marketplace than Scottish lamb. How could that possibly be?
How could that be?
Well, it's because a 3,000-ton cargo ship pushing this floating mass of cargo through the water takes very little carbon load per pound. And Scottish lamb is driven there by truck. But in addition to that, the more meaningful factor is the feed inputs, the growing of feed for the lambs up in Scotland, whereas the lambs in New Zealand are grazed. The miles going to Vietnam and back, it's amazing. It's really less carbon load than a semi-trailer going from Monterey, where the sardines are caught, to Seattle, because a truck is just not nearly as efficient. So
We had talked earlier about some of the product that was airlifted in and how huge the carbon footprint of that is. It's like buying a ticket for a fish to fly on a plane. That's just kind of crazy.
Yes. Well, okay. You know, one plane trip for a person from San Francisco to New York is the same carbon load responsibility as owning a car for a year. Mm-hmm. So you put a box of fish on a plane, that's like owning a car for 4 months. So mm-hmm. I try to eat frozen fish from Alaska myself because mm-hmm. I think, number one, it's really high quality mm-hmm. and you don't have that carbon load on that air-flown fish.
Some of the places that are doing the canning for you, are there concerns about social justice issues? You know, are there fair wage? Are the working conditions well? Or is that one of the things that you guys are looking into?
We absolutely do. They have to pass a social audit, and the places we use have passed social audits that we require that Whole Foods, for example, requires. We also mm-hmm. partner with Whole Foods to produce their 365 branded tuna. That's just a recent development. We got that. It's a very nice contract with them and a great partnership with a very socially responsible corporation.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like using the clout of both organizations, you can accomplish a lot more.
Yes. Well, their clout is much larger than ours, you know.
Well.
And, yeah, the only point that, and this was brought up to me, and I know we're kind of diverging, but in Vietnam, the only point where the plant had a little black mark was that they allow their employees to have 8 hours a week of overtime. And the employees desire that 8 hours a week of overtime. But the social audit requires that they only work 40 hours. So there was a conflict there that we were able to resolve. But
right.
So, you know, social audit isn't perfect. It has to accommodate for what the workers themselves want and not just sure. enforce upon them what we expect them to have in their lives. They are, right. you know, independent of us after all.
So let's talk about Wild Planet and kind of the structure of Wild Planet and who are the investors in Wild Planet and who wants to see it succeed.
That's really worthy of note. The lead investor to our 2008 private equity round that really gave us the capacity financially to go out and do this national outreach was the Sea Change Fund, which is a fund established by the Packard Foundation with a mission to support companies that have a mission for sustainability. So they are currently 1/3 owners of Wild Planet. I retained fractional interest myself. I was happy just to keep the job, really. The second largest owner, the investor, is someone who doesn't like me talking about his name, but he's a really well-known owner of a natural food line. Uh-huh. And a brand that everybody just loves. But he's just kind of a quiet guy and doesn't uh-huh. want it to be known. But he stepped in and was a secondary investor. Then we have quite a number of smaller investors that learned about it. A lot of his marketing people and people that learned about our company, they all jump in with personal investments. So we have a very tightly held investment group. And that investment group has no interest in an exit strategy, just selling our company to someone quickly just for a profit. Mm-hmm. We all have plans to retire and have the company continue running.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that's always kind of nice is that you feel like there's somebody that is taking responsibility for the long haul. And that's something that you don't see a lot of. You get really excited about a product, then you find out it was sold to some major corporation, and then you're disappointed again. But this sounds like you guys are in it for the long haul.
Well, that second investor, in fact, was offered $120 million for his company by General Mills, and he turned it down. So he's really in it for
the long
haul.
I like him already.
He's a great guy. You know, once you have a certain amount of money in life, what do you really want to do with a big pile more? I just don't see the point, really.
Yeah. So how many people are working here locally, and where are your offices located?
We're located in downtown McKinleyville.
Oh, nice.
Because I don't want to drive to Eureka. We do have a dock facility in Eureka, but I live uh-huh. in McKinleyville, and almost everyone there in the company does. There are 11 of us in the main office, and then we have people in Eureka, Crescent City, and Newport, Oregon that work the dock operations. We have a new facility that we're going to be occupying on the waterfront at the foot of C Street. We are one of the two anchor tenants to the Fisherman's Terminal.
Oh, great.
And so that should be finished in about 2 months. And we're going to do some value-added boutique niche-focused processing in that building just as soon as they finish. We've been waiting for 18 years.
You're patient, though.
It'll pay off.
And if people want to buy Wild Planet items right now, where locally can people pick those up?
Of course, the co-ops, Eureka Natural Food, Wildberries, Murphy's Market. I'm going to leave somebody out here, aren't I? That's going to be bad. We aren't that well distributed locally. We're side by side with the Carvalho product, which uh-huh. still is uh-huh. being offered too, because many people got started with that back in 2004. But you know, we're sold nationally now. Between 6,000 and 7,000 stores carry us nationally, and we're enjoying a triple-digit annual growth.
And those would be stores like Whole Foods?
Whole Foods has us nationally. Uh-huh. Down the Bay Area, Molly Stone's, Andronico's. We're in Fred Meyer, Kroger's nationally. We're in Wegmans and smaller regional chains. We do very well.
Well, we're very lucky to have Wild Planet Foods located locally and to be able to pick it up whenever we want to. This is Jennifer Bell, and I've been talking with Bill Carvalho. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Come on to my house, I'm gonna give you apple, plum, and every kind of tea.
If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call the listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archived programs at khsu.org. This program is also available on iTunes. Food for Thought is produced in the KHSU studios located at Humboldt State University. Our engineer is Jessica Eden and producer is Jennifer Bell. Join us again next Friday on KHSU for another edition of Food for Thought during the KHSU homepage.